Okay, do you want me to do kind of the state and stop and then go into the federal? Yeah, okay. All right, well, our team every year, we're at the state capitol in Topeka. Myself and two other members of our lobby team. And every year, before session starts, we have our convention in November where members review our policies, kind of give us our marching orders. And from that, we've got a few new policies we're going to work on at the Capitol. I think top of everyone's mind, whether you're in agriculture or otherwise, are property taxes. They've continued to go up, and certainly with agriculture, we're pretty asset land heavy, and property taxes hit us. And so we're going to have a pretty good focus on trying to cut. In Kansas, there's two different ways that property tax, two different avenues property taxes are assessed. One's by the state. State has 21 and a half mills. 20 of that goes to the state general fund intended for education. And then a bulk of the property tax is probably about 85% on average are assessed by local units of government. And so we're working the legislature to really hone in on the 21 and a half state mills and see if we can reduce those to get us some property tax relief. At the same time, we're also fighting what we'd call probably a bad idea. There's a group of legislators who want to cap valuations so that valuations, your appraisals can't go up more than 3%. The problem with that, where things sit right now, is when you think about how property taxes are determined, you take your appraisal, which is usually set by your county appraiser, or on ag land, it's our use value formula. And then you take that times the assessment rate. So that's set in the Constitution. It doesn't change. And then you take it times your mills. Well, like I said, 85% of the mills are set by local governments. And essentially, they set their budget, their spending authority, and then the county clerks apply the mill levies. Well, if you cap appraisals, and you have certain asset classes growing faster than others, and in Kansas, the big thing, probably everywhere, we're short houses, it seems like. So that residential properties have grown faster than 3%, sometimes by double digits. But commercial, agriculture, utilities, other real land asset classes haven't grown more than 3%. And so what you do when you cap one asset class at 3%, all it does is shift the burden over on the agriculture and commercial, because the locals are still going to raise the same amount of taxes. It's just who's paying it. So we're going to work, yeah, try and push back on that. The mill levies. So the mill levy is basically a thousandth of a percent. And so when, that's when you look at that, it's you take the when the locals figure out what their budget is. The clerk looks at how much assessed value is in the county, or in the city or whatever the local unit of government is, and then they apply this percentage, and that's how much you're going to be the percentage of your assessed value that's going to be taxed, and that's how you get the actual tax dollars from that formula. So you take your appraisal. So, oh, on the statewide mills, yeah. So, yeah, at the state level, they just assess 21 and a half mills, and we're trying to reduce that 20 mills in education. Probably take that down somewhere between 2 to 4 mills. So that's easy math, right? You reduce the mill levy, you just pay less taxes. So that's what we're doing in property tax. There's a few other items too that we're going to work on more, maybe ag centric. This came out of convention this year. There was a milk processing plant in Hugoton that defaulted, went bankrupt, if you will. And in that process, we had one of our members, a cash seller of milk, basically get taken for a lot of money. And much so on the cattle side, we've got the packer trust, the dealer trust, market trust. Milk producers don't have that. We have a significant dairy council presence in our membership. Texas has a milk trust, and so we're going to kind of work off of Texas's milk trust and see if we can get protection for cash seller of milk so that in the event of a bankruptcy or default of a processor, that they're the first ones to get made whole, because that's really not, they're not extending credit. So the other thing we're going to work on is we've had, particularly in the Flint Hills, but also in the Red Hills, some other grassland areas in the state, we've had a lot of out-of-state hunters come in. And usually when they come in from areas that have a lot of wooded areas, and they want to turn our native grasslands, it seems like, in the trees. And while that's their property and they can do what they want, we have a a deer tag in Kansas that's kind of providing a perverse incentive for folks to buy land. So most out-of-staters, so if you're in Missouri and you want to come hunt in Kansas, you'd have to apply to a draw, and it's somewhere around $500 if you win the draw to get a tag and come hunt, plus your regular hunting license. Not everybody gets the draw. Well, if you buy land, 80 acres, you can right now you can get what's called a non-resident landowner or tenant tag, and so you pay the residential tag fee of, I think it's $40. And all you got to do is you got to have 80 acres. So we're providing this incentive for folks to come buy land that then take it out of production, don't maintain it, and it's starting to cause some issues with noxious weeds, woody encroachment. And so, we're not trying to tell them, hey, we're going to tell you what to do with your land, but we're going to try and take away this incentive. Yeah, it's just repealing that section of the statute. And so these non-resident folks can still come and hunt. They just have to participate in the draw like everybody else. Just because you own land doesn't mean you're going to get in. So the hope is that we'll at least maybe disincentivize some folks from buying land here, just to, hunt deer on, try and keep it in production. The other thing, this is a holdover from last couple sessions. There's been a focus on foreign adversaries, both at the national and state level. And Kansas has some restrictions in our corporate farm law restrictions, but some legislators want to beef it up. Our kind of role in that, if you look at our policies, we're generally a free market outfit. Don't want government interfering in the marketplace. On this particular issue, our board looked at it and said, okay, well, if there's a national security interest here, and we're really going after the national security interest, then that's probably fine, but let's make sure that it's, focused on that. And so we worked with leadership in the House last year to develop a bill that's focused on six foreign adversaries listed by the State Department, prevents them from acquiring not just ag land, but any land, and focuses on distance from military installations. And we've pushed back against, there were some bills that wanted to cut off all foreign purchases of land. And we said, that's probably going a bit too far. I can think of a number of members who have married Canadian citizens, and that might not be such a great idea. The other, just two other things at the state level before we get into anything on federal level. The K-State Dairy is pretty antiquated, in dire need of renovations, and so we adopted a policy to work with K-State and other stakeholders to try and find a way to renovate that dairy. Bring it up into modern times and hopefully get a better facility to train students in the dairy industry. So, and then finally, our Kansas Corporation Commission. There's been, and I know this has affected folks in Missouri too. There's some interstate transmission lines that have crossed Kansas into Missouri. One's the Great Belt Express, but then there's also the Blackberry. Next there is Blackberry Line. And a lot of our members, particularly around the Blackberry Line, have felt like that company did not pay attention to setbacks from homes and livestock facilities, really didn't work with landowners. And they feel like our members that if right now our corporation commission is appointed by the governor, they feel like if we were to get those elected, that they'd have probably a better pulse of landowners, people in the country. And so we're going to see if there's some interest to try and move that direction. So pretty full list at the state level. Yeah, I think there's a misunderstanding that somehow valuations equal I'm paying higher taxes, and that's not necessarily the case. Because when you look at the purpose of property tax, it really is a tax on wealth, and that's why our members hate it so much. But that's what it is. And if you're going to tax wealth, the point is you need to get the actual value of the asset to then apply the tax rate to. And so, if we're artificially capping the value of the asset, we're not getting the true tax rate on that asset. And again, if one asset class grows faster than the other, all you're doing, at least for the local assessments, is you're just shifting who pays it. And right now, and this could change 5, 10 years down the road, but right now, it would shift it on to agriculture and commercial property owners. And so, and we've just gone through in Kansas because we have a use value appraisal system that the land is appraised based on the income producing potential, not on fair market value. So it's a basically an 8-year average of 8-year averages of prices, crop prices, and input expenses. And on the grass side, it's kind of its equation of cash rent versus and with some deductions for fence water expenses. We just got done going through about 10 years of double digit valuation increases under that formula. As we had, think back to when the RFS went in place back in 07, corn prices ramped up pretty quickly over that period. And so there's a 2-year delay in that formula too. So we had a number of years there where grain prices were good, and so taxes went up by have gone up double digits, and they finally plateaued, right? We're starting to get into lower crop prices. And so we're finally at a point where we're starting to get some relief from these valuation increases. And if we put this cap in place in an era where we should be decreasing our tax liability relative to the other asset classes, if you cap it and it caps residential, but not us because we're going down, we're going to continue to pay more, even though we shouldn't be based on how the formula works. And so, but again, it gets to valuation is only one part of the 3-part formula. And so capping valuation does not, at the end of the day, result in lower taxes because the side on the local government is just dependent on their budget. So they're going to raise the amount of tax money they need to run that local government. It's just, again, who's paying it? And if you shift valuation, it just shifts who pays it. I think there's a big groundswell of folks in the more urban areas from a residential perspective that want some relief. And I think a lot of folks, again, they just see the value, the assessed value of their homes going up. But the market for homes has gone up, right? I don't know how long you've lived in your home. I've lived in mine for about 12 years, and it has darn near doubled in a time span. So it's hard to say that valuations are necessarily out of whack, by the appraisals when we've seen that in the marketplace. And so what you really need to do is figure out a way to, decrease the amount of taxes that each person's paying, and that really gets to the local government budgets or the state or on the 20 21 and a half mils of state government's budgets. Can we find ways for these governments to spend less? Well, and see, and I hate it when commissioners say that, because my first response to a commissioner when they say that is, no, why don't you cut your budgets? Because it shouldn't matter. Look, if the value of ag land and residential land all goes up, that means they have more value to assess their tax rates on. So just drop your tax rates by cutting your budgets. Why? What are you spending the money on? So commissioners like to do that. They like to deflect and blame valuations, but it's not. They're actually doing it in their budgets. Right. I, in addition to my job here at KLA for, I've served on my small town city council and currently on school board, and it really gets down to, in those budgets, is there a way that we can keep costs down? And sometimes it's tough for rural areas, because there's a lot of challenges we face with declining population, but still a need for services to keep roads open. So it's hard. Yeah. I mean, just like, we've seen, food go up the grocery store, vehicles go up on our personal expenses. Well, cities are facing the same thing, right? Their employees want to keep their pay in line with inflation. They've got to buy those aggregates to put on the road. They're facing the same cost increases too. And so, yeah, it's you just got to find ways to get more efficient. Well, It's interesting because, for the folks who aren't going to like this are the out of state hunters, right? And they don't vote for our elected officials. So it'll be interesting, I think, when we are able to get the bill introduced to see if anybody comes out opposed to it. We've got a meeting set up with our Secretary of Wildlife and Parks. From our thought process, this would actually, we think, help them because they're fee based. They make most of their revenue off selling licenses. Well, if we get rid of this really cheap tag and force these out of state folks to go into the draw and, increase the cost from $40 to $400 or $500, that gets the state more revenue. So, well, I think for a lot of our young ranchers, they'd like to see that competition go away, right? And that was raised, that we're trying to keep land, we're trying to, graze cattle, or if it's farmland, farm it, keep it in production, keep it doing good things. And our, especially our younger folks, cannot compete with some of these folks that are doctors or lawyers or whatever. That can come in and run up the bill, so to speak, and then just not use it. Yeah, and and it's not to say all out of state folks don't manage their land right. We've got I farm with my farm and ranch, my family in North Central Kansas, and we've got friends from Michigan that own land, and we help maintain it, but they also let us burn the grasslands and put up hay and use the property. No, so the foreign ownership of land deal. No, that the way the bill was drafted last year, it was all land, and that was a point that we made, both us and other groups like Farm Bureau here in Kansas. We said, hey, look, if this is really about national security, we're concerned about foreign actors coming in, then we shouldn't just limit this to ag land. And honestly, so we have, I think everybody thinks of Fort Riley, Fort Leavenworth, McConnell Air Force Base in Wichita. And I'd say, what puts us more at risk? A Chinese national buying a quarter section down in the southwest corner of Kansas where there's literally nothing, or a Chinese national buying a home just outside of Fort Riley? So why would we just apply this to agriculture? And like I said, yeah, the thing we've made sure is we're just focusing on those foreign folks who are listed as adversaries, folks like China, Russia, Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, and North Korea, I think are the listed entities. North Korea. And interestingly enough, you probably may know that there's a federal law that actually requires foreign owners to report their holdings to USDA. And every year, USDA puts out a report. The acronym's AFIDA, AFIDA. Interestingly enough, it only lists Chinese nationals is owning a half acre in Russell County, Kansas. And we figured out through property records that it's We think a Chinese woman who married a U.S. citizen, and they have a she has a small fruit vegetable stand across from the Dollar General there in Russell. So it's not that big a deal. And there's a reason for that because we because of our corporate farm laws put some restrictions on corporations. Yeah, so the bill, at least the bill that passed last year, but got vetoed by the governor, it applied to not just foreign governments, but citizens of the foreign government, business entities like corporations, LLCs, controlled by a foreign citizen or foreign company. So it was broader than just the governments themselves. Well, there is an exception if they're a dual citizen. So if they're also a U.S. citizen, so. Okay. Well, I'd say probably the top of everybody's mind, I think, are two things: Farm Bill and the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, those tax provisions expiring. So I think our focus is on kind of both those, with a number of things under those umbrellas. On the tax front, I think for agriculture, first and foremost, is if by the end of this year, if we don't extend the provisions, the death tax. Will the exemption rate for the death tax will basically be cut in half. Right now it's a little over 13 million. It'll drop to somewhere around 7, which it could really, I mean, you think of price of land nowadays, that's going to hit a lot of family farms. So I mean, we love to just repeal it. We think it's bad policy, but we at least need to extend those current exemption levels. The other thing with TCJA, obviously, just about every tax bracket would get a rate increase. So they've got to do something with that. The interest deduction, there's a piece in there that puts some limits but has an exemption for agriculture because, particularly on our feed yards, members that feed cattle, the limits on how much revenue gross is based on gross revenue, not on net. And so feed yards, when you think about it, they turn over 2.5 times a year on average. And it doesn't take a very big feed yard to hit those, and then you can't deduct interest. So there's an exemption in there, and we want to make sure that stays in place. And then obviously, bonus depreciation has been phasing out over the last few years and is going to completely phase out here after the next year. And so trying to get some level of bonus depreciation put back in place. Those are, I think, the main things we're looking at on the Tax Cut Jobs Act front. There's a number of other provisions, but I think those are ones we're most focused on. Well, so when the TCJA passed in 2017, for whatever reason, they wanted to limit the ability of certain taxpayers to deduct interest from their taxable income. That's obviously an issue in agriculture. A lot of us have operating loans, land loans. And so we went to work, and I forget the base level, but it's based on gross revenue. Like if you're over a certain level of gross revenue, and I can't remember it off the top of my head, but once you hit it, you no longer, if you're below it, you can deduct your interest. So I think most farms and ranches, cow calf operations would probably be able to do it. But once you hit this gross revenue target, you can no longer deduct interest unless you make a certain election on how to depreciate assets. And that's been useful for feed yards. Again, it does not take a very big feed yard to hit gross revenue because they're turning inventory. And so we want to make sure that that election stays in place so that feed yards can continue to deduct interest. If we can jump in the farm bill, I guess, I think for most of the livestock, or at least the cattle sector, a good farm bill for us is one that mostly leaves us out, right? We don't want subsidies. We don't want it government interfering in our business. And so our, I think, interest here are just a few items. One may not necessarily be a farm bill issue, but could be dealt with in the farm bill is, and you've probably heard that they're getting ready to redo the dietary guidelines. And the science committee, which is really skewed in their views, decided that we needed to eat less meat protein, and it has drastically cut the amount of meat protein on the plate and increased like peas, lentils, that sort of thing. Meanwhile, still having, carbohydrates and all these other things that, it seems like we've had these dietary guidelines in place, and as long as they've been in place, it seems like our physical fitness has our health around food has gotten worse. Our diets have gotten worse. And maybe I think from our perspective, if there's really some good things about having meat as part of the diet, proteins, vitamins, and so we want to kind of hit reset on this scientific dietary committee and see if we can hit reset here and maybe take a little different look at this and how can we improve our health outcomes and try and make sure that meat protein stays on the plate. Well, I think that the key is you've got to start with a good foundation. And I think this science committee that kind of does the background before the government actually goes in and sets the new regs, really kind of veered off into the left lane here, and trying to make sure we have good quality scientists, dietitians there. I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to see that obesity rates have increased. Well, what are we doing? We're not eating more meat. I mean, we're putting carbohydrates and things that increase diabetes and obesity. We need to, and I think too, I think there's probably an error here under this of some of the folks there, they have an anti-meat agenda and it's not based on health. Based on animal welfare issues, and that really shouldn't have no place in this dietary discussion. So, other issues I think Farm Bill related, we've got to focus on foreign animal disease preparedness. I know we put last Farm Bill an emphasis on the vaccine bank. Once again, we'll make sure that's stocked and in the programs to, we're just got high path avian influenza we're dealing with and dairies and who knows what the next disease is, making sure we have those programs, those agencies with what they the tools they need. The new Oh, yeah. So the current the reg that just went into effect in November, we did support that. And I think there's some things that we've stressed as we've talked to folks to remember about this rule. It's only animals, 18 months and older, No, well, I should back up. I say, way I kind of talk about this rule is, if you weren't having to individually ID your animal before, like with metal, bangs tags or metal clip tags, you don't need an EID now. Okay, so it's only these breeding age animals, or if it's rodeo or show stock. So that hasn't changed. We're not talking about, feeder steers, feeder heifers, anything like that. It's these breeding age cows that are going across state lines. And the other thing is, we went to work and got some funding, and we still need to do that because we're in this continuing resolution. So we got to make sure that we get enough funding, because if we don't, we could run short. But making sure that the EID tags, like the metal tags, are free for those folks that need to put them in. So yeah, we supported it. And the other thing too, and I dealt with this with a member, if your cows have the metal tags in now, I was talking to a member who is grazing, is based in Kansas, but sends cows into Nebraska to graze on corn stalks in the winter. And I said, if your cows already have those metal clips in, you don't have to go replace them or add in. Just do it to your heifers that you're replacing in there every year. So that's the other thing too. If you got the metal ones, you're grandfathered in. And so I think there's a lot of misunderstanding around the rule, but yeah, we do favor it. We want to make sure that if we do have a disease outbreak, that we can, particularly in those breeding age animals, trace it. No, it was foreign animal disease preparedness. So there's a that has to do with like an F. We have a foot and mouth disease vaccine bank that's actually maintained in Kansas now at NBAF, and making sure that that has enough vaccines should we have an outbreak of FMD, and making sure other disease prevention agencies within USDA have the funding and tools they need to do the research and try and figure out how to stop these emerging diseases. So that's what that's about. J essentially funding in the Farm Bill for those programs. And then the other thing I think that we're interested in is, and I know the House had this in their draft last year, is a solution to Prop 12 in California. That's, where basically California says, we're going to ban, gestation crates and veal crates and anything that's confined. And not only are we going to ban it here, but we're going to ban importation of anything from another state. That really, I think, if you talk to folks in California, disrupted their particular pork markets. But it has a effect too on eggs and poultry, and from our perspective, they haven't got to, cattle yet. But what if they said, no feedlots, find, the pens big enough so that we couldn't do any of that anymore. And so we're asking Congress to do one of the things that's expressly listed in the Constitution. The Commerce Clause gives Congress the ability to regulate commerce among states. This is squarely within Congress's jurisdiction, and we want them to fix it. Well, I think essentially what it says is, I think the way they kind of phrased it is, if we're not going to tell you, California, how you're going to tell your producers, like, you can ban gestation crates all day, but you cannot keep out pork from, let's say, Kansas, or beef from Kansas, if it was raised following the production standards set by the federal government in the state where it's raised. And that allows the flow of commerce to continue. So, for whatever reason, if California doesn't want gestation crates or whatever, that's fine. They just can't prevent our good, wholesome products from other states from coming in being. Well, it would be a federal law that essentially invalidates the state law, because through the supremacy clause and the commerce clause, Congress can do that. Well, the law in California would simply be on the books, but a portion of it would be invalid. So California's law would still function and say, hey, California pork producers, you can't have gestation crates, or farrowing crates or whatever that definition is. But it would say, hey, Kansans, if Kansas allows gestation crates, farrowing crates, and your pork, meets all the other production, food safety components in Kansas, you can sell into California. We can't stop. So, yep. Well, I think they're going to hit reset because you had a bill that, well, the Senate really didn't do anything to the last minute, and I think that was just a last minute Hail Mary to try and do something. But you've now got a Senate controlled by Republicans, previously controlled by Democrats, but you still don't have 60 votes, right? In the Senate, you got to have 60 votes to break cloture. The Republicans have 53 votes. So whatever you do, you've got to get another 7 votes to be able to proceed to debate the bill in the Senate. And in the House, they only have a couple member margin there. It's super tight. They're going to have a couple members are going to lose for a brief period of time, like Mike Walls and some others that are getting appointed to the administration. They'll have to fill those special elections. And so they're really close on numbers. And in the House, the deal there is you can rule by simple majority. The problem is that the Republican caucus has a number of different factions. And we just saw this with the continuing resolution, right? We've got some fiscal conservatives who are not going to want to authorize more spending on things like food stamps, which make up the vast majority of spending in the bill. But they'll also protest things like there's a push, I think, by some of the committee chairs to increase the Title I payments. There'll be a number of Republicans push back on that, particularly from urban areas. So then you've got to gain Democrat votes in the House to get the bill through. So it's in both chambers, it's kind of figuring out this narrow line of how do we control spending, control entitlements, and kind of keep this coalition of folks in line. Yeah, well, it's the same at any level. You've got to get most people to agree with you, and this is no different, so. I think everybody wants to get it done. I mean, it's been extended twice for a year each time. It's time to get it done. But just, I think it'll be easier said than done. But I think I think a good chance something happens. But they'll have to make some adjustments. I don't know that what went through last made it out of the House Ag Committee last year is going to make it out again. And keep in mind, what made it out of House Ag Committee last year didn't get across the floor. So yeah, so yeah, we'll see what happens. So At the state level, I think the property tax relief will happen. I think at the end of the day, they're gonna our legislature is gonna end up cutting those statewide mills. They may also there's a way to give property like residential property owners some relief without shifting the burden onto others, and they may look at has to do with exempting a certain amount of value of the home from those statewide mill levies. So they may do that. They did that last year to an extent. They may do it again. I think the foreign ownership restriction bill, I think this year probably third time's the charm. I think they'll get it done this year. And then the others, we talked about like milk trusts and deer, those are new policies, and we'll see where those goes. I honestly have no idea. And we've kind of talked among our guys. We'd love to get them done this year, but sometimes these things are, 2 year or more strategies. And on the federal level, I think the tax cuts do get extended. It's just, do they just extend what's there, or are they going to have other add-ons? I know there's been some discussion, things the president wants, some things other members want, but at the end of the day, are they really going to do it? Yeah, I'm interested to see how what DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, not really department, but I'm interested to see what they actually identify, because, and not just what they identify, because I could probably go through and identify a bunch of things that don't make a lot of sense and spend money that don't need to. Is there political will among members of Congress to actually follow through on the recommendations? Two really smart business guys, right? Or are we just gonna go back and whine about this thing or that thing, or we want this instead of seeing the big picture of we continue to rack up debt? And was it the is it the now the number one expenditure is interest? I mean, it's incredible, the amount of money we're paying just on the interest on the debt. And so are we going to, actually buckle down? And this goes for both parties. We all seem to, Republicans seem to want to talk about it, but then when it comes down to really cutting, man, it's hard. We can't do it. And we all want to talk about discretionary spending, but that's such a small portion of the pie. It's the entitlements that really cost the money, and nobody wants to touch those. So discretionary spending would be like defense, your annual spending bills, things that Congress approves every year, your kind of your basic agency operations. Entitlements would be like welfare, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, Farm Bill, so food stamps and the Farm Bill, Farm Bill Title I, essentially is an entitlement. And what entitlement means is it's spending that's already authorized. It just operates. It doesn't have to be appropriated every year. Yeah, so, from our perspective, being part of KLA, I think a lot of the reason folks, there's a lot of reasons to be a part of the association. But one is you've got folks like me and our other two lobbyists, Taylor and Jackie, who are at the Capitol every day. I mean, I don't think most ranchers want to go out and ranch, right? They don't want to hang around with politicians. And so that's what we're here for. So by being part of this association, you can participate in policy making procedures, you know, every year, tell us what to do. And we also have an opportunity, not just at our convention, but then come up here in February. Every year we have a legislative meeting, and it's about halfway through our legislative session. We'll get together all the bills that are out there, summarize them, and where we have policy, we'll tell you, hey, here's what we're doing. Some bills are in a gray area, so it's a good opportunity for our members to look at the bills and say, hey, I think we ought to do something with this and make a recommendation to our board. So there's opportunities to engage there. But I tell folks too, like, look, we if we're good at our jobs as lobbyists, we build a reputation as a resource. But at the end of the day, what moves a legislator, it is you, the voter. And so particularly at the state level, when they have coffees or, you know, morning breakfast with constituents or whatever, go meet them, talk to them, get to know them, build that relationship. So when something happens, well, if something bad's happening or we're trying to make something good happen, we'll let you know. And if you've got that relationship, then man, it's so easy to call them or email them. They'll know who you are. And well, I think one is we're just busy, right? Labor short, we're all kind of burning the candle at both ends. And I think it's hard for producers to make one, just make the time. Not sometimes I think that, you know, if we just take 1 or 2 days out of our entire year to just set it aside and say, hey, we're gonna go talk about things that impact me. And it's a long-term view, right? Maybe nothing happens this session, but when's the next bad thing going to happen, and turn into real dollars and cents? So just make some time. I think the other thing is too, sometimes with organizations, folks zero in on one particular item where like they just so disagree, they just can't bring themselves to be members or participate. And I think that's kind of a short-sighted view. I mean, man, I don't, there are very few people I agree with on everything. But I think find an organization, whether it's us or somebody else, where you agree with most of what they do. But the other thing is too, with an organization, you want to make sure you're investing in one that puts in the time and actually does things. I'm not going to throw anybody under the bus by name, but I know there's some other organizations out there that say they're representing the producer. And then this will be, I think, my 14th session here at the State House. I can count on one, maybe two hands, probably one, the amount of times I've seen their staff in the Capitol. And so I think do your homework when people tell you, oh, we're representing you, the ag producer, cattleman, whatever. Are they really there? Are they really, like I said, we have somebody there every day. When bills come up in the Ag Committee, we're testifying. You know, our lobbyists are there in front of the committees every day. Make sure you're joining an organization that's there and gets it done. Hundred percent, and you know, even as lobbyists, I can see it. Like, I We build relationships with all legislators, but man, the ones that represent where I live, I have more ability to talk to them and for them to listen than all the rest of the legislators combined. And it's because I can vote for them. I can influence my neighbors to vote for them. I think we covered a lot.